Today's panel discussion is entitled The Administrative State on Trial. My name is Brian Johnson, and I'm a member of the Executive Committee of the Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group and the chair of its CFPB Working Group. Today's panel was jointly organized with the Executive Committee of the Federalism and Separation of Powers Practice Group. I have the privilege of introducing the moderator of today's panel discussion, the Honorable Eleni Rumel. Judge Rumel was appointed judge of the United States Court of Federal Claims in February 2020. She previously served as the deputy counsel to Vice President Mike Pence from 2018 to 2020. Prior to her tenure at the White House, she served from 2012 to 2018 as assistant general counsel in the U.S. House of Representatives Office of General Counsel. Prior to her government service, Judge Rumel had a distinguished career in private practice. Judge Rumel, welcome. Thank you for being here today. I turn the program over to you to introduce our distinguished panelists and begin the discussion.
Thank you so much, Brian. Thank you, and good afternoon, everybody. For those of you who are in the crowd and for those of you who are joining us online, I am Eleni Rumel. I'll be moderating today's discussion. We have a very interesting topic lined up for you today. For this panel, we'll be discussing recent developments in administrative law and their potential impact on federal agencies. To do this, we'll generally be focusing on four lines of cases. And these cases have challenged agency authority on separation of powers grounds and have the potential to really affect agency structure and practices and perhaps the balance of power between the branches. So the first group of cases involve the jurisdiction of federal courts over administrative proceedings. And earlier this year, the Supreme Court ruled in Axon v. FTC, and SEC v. Cochran that district courts retain original jurisdiction over constitutional challenges in certain agency proceedings, which means that plaintiffs must no longer wait until their agency proceedings end to file their complaint in federal court when challenging, for example, an agency's structure or procedure or its existence. One of our panelists here with us today, Greg Garr, argued the Cochran case, and we're especially looking forward to hearing from him about his perspective and perhaps some of the next steps in his case. The next group of cases that we'll discuss are the student loan cases. United States Department of Education v. Brown, and Biden v. Nebraska. And these concern the Biden administration's authority to forgive student loan debt under the HEROES Act. And these cases were recently heard at oral argument by the Supreme Court, and they raise important questions about the major questions doctrine, statutory interpretation, and of course, standing. And the third group of cases involve the constitutionality of the funding of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the CFPB. The Supreme Court recently granted cert in CFPB v. Community Financial Services Association, and the case will be heard this fall. Notably, there is a circuit split on the issues in this case. The Fifth Circuit and the Second Circuit have issued contrary opinions on the topic, and this is a really fascinating case, not only because of the administrative law implications of the case, but also because it involves interesting standing questions. And naturally, the outcome in the case could have a significant impact on how Congress can structure federal agencies, and that's something we'll explore more today during the discussion. And finally, the Supreme Court is also considering a cert petition in Jarchese v. SEC, and in that case, the Fifth Circuit ruled that the Security and Exchange Commission's in-house administrative law proceedings violated the Seventh Amendment right to a jury trial, the non-delegation doctrine, and the Constitution's take care clause. So as you can see, many of the same concepts, such as the major questions doctrine and the non-delegation doctrine, are implicated in these cases, and there's really no shortage of activity in the administrative law field this year. And the outcomes in these cases may potentially affect the current existence and the structure of our current administrative state. So to discuss these issues, we have lined up today Really a quite a distinguished panel. I'm so pleased to be on the same panel with all of you. And I think I will just go down the line here and introduce you one by one. I will start with Greg Garr, who's on the far right here. He is a partner in the Washington, D.C. office of Latham & Watkins and the global chair of the firm's Supreme Court and appellate practice. He served as the 44th Solicitor General of the United States, acting as the federal government's top lawyer before the Supreme Court, and was responsible for overseeing the government's litigation in federal appellate courts throughout the nation. Prior to his nomination by the president and unanimous confirmation as SG, he served as Principal Deputy Solicitor General from 2005 to 2008, and then as Acting Solicitor General. He also served as an Assistant Solicitor General from 2000 to 2004, spending almost a decade, it seems, in the office. And I am told that he is the only person to have held all these positions within the Office of Solicitor General. Mr. Garr has argued 48 cases before the Supreme Court and has served as counsel of records in hundreds of other cases before the court. And perhaps most notable for this panel, as I mentioned, Mr. Garr argued the Cochran case this current term, a case in which the justices ruled unanimously in his client's favor. Mr. Garr received his law degree with high honors from George Washington University Law School, where he served as the editor-in-chief, and he received his BA cum laude from Dartmouth College, where he was the Rufus Choate Scholar. After graduating from law school, he served as a law clerk to Chief Justice Rehnquist and also to Judge Sirica of the Third Circuit. Also joining us today, next to him, is Professor Richard Pierce. Professor Pierce is the Lyle T. Alverson Professor of Law at George Washington University School of Law. Professor Pierce's academic work focuses on administrative law and government regulation, with a particular focus on the energy industry. He is the author of over 20 books and over 150 articles on these topics, and his work has been cited in hundreds of judicial opinions, including over a dozen in opinions of the United States Supreme Court. Since 1994, Professor Pierce has also served as an author of Kenneth Culp Davis's Administrative Law Treatise, the premier reference guide for the field of administrative law. And his work in the field has led him to testify in the House before the Judiciary Committee and the House Committee on the Budget as an administrative law expert. He received his law degree from UVA's School of Law and his Bachelor of Science in Economics from Lehigh University. And last, but certainly not least, is Professor Chad Squitieri. Chad Squitieri is the Assistant Professor of Law at Catholic University. It's Columbus School of Law, where he teaches administrative law, constitutional law and technology. He joined the faculty last year after having practiced at Gibson Dunn as a member of the Appellate and Constitutional Law and Regulatory and Administrative Law Practice Groups. Before that, he served in the executive branch as a special assistant to former United States Secretary of Labor, Eugene Scalia, and a law clerk to then Chief Judge D. Brooke Smith of the Third Circuit. Professor Squitieri's scholarship addresses administrative law and constitutional law topics. His scholarship has appeared in numerous law reviews, the Missouri Law Review, the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy, and the Virginia Law Review, among many others. Important to today's discussion, he has also recently written articles about the non-delegation doctrine and the major questions doctrine, and we are interested and excited to hear your perspective as it relates to the discussion today. And he has also serves as a fellow with the Project for Constitutional Originalism and the Catholic Intellectual Tradition. Professor Squitieri also graduated from the University of Virginia School of Law and earned his Bachelor of Science from Florida State University, double majoring in finance and economics. So please help me welcome this distinguished panel. So I think what we'll do is we'll begin by hearing 8 to 10 minute opening statements from each panelist, And then we'll move to a discussion of the cases that I mentioned. And finally, we'll open things up to questions from the audience. So please be thinking about and considering what questions you may want to ask. Why don't we go down the line? Greg, would you like to begin?
Sure thing. Thanks, Judge. I'm going to talk about the Axon and Cochran case as well as touch on the Jarkissi case a little bit. And as the judge mentioned at the outset, we, along with the New Civil Liberties Alliance, and including Peggy Little, who I see in the audience today, represented Ms. Cochran before the Supreme Court. So forgive me if this presentation is a little bit skewed, but I think it's fair. So the basic question in Cochran and the Axon case, which were two consolidated cases that were argued separately and decided together a week and a half ago, was whether the federal district courts have jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. 1331 to hear structural constitutional challenges to agency proceedings before the SEC in the Cochran case and the FTC in the Axon case. And to just give you a general overview of the issue, Section 1331, as you probably remember from your law school days, grants broad jurisdiction over, quote, all civil actions arising under constitution, laws, or treaties of the United States. And it's phrased in mandatory terms that the court, district court, shall have that jurisdiction. But the government has long argued that statutes creating administrative review schemes that give you an opportunity to petition a final decision of the agency for review to a federal court of appeals impliedly displace the federal district court's jurisdiction under Section 1331 to hear constitutional challenges to those proceedings at the outset. And if you looked at just the text of 1331, you might be a little bit surprised by that. But the court, going back to a decision in 2009 called Thunder Basin Coal versus Reich, had developed a sort of three-factor test that largely placed a thumb on the scale of finding that district courts had been impliedly stripped of their jurisdiction anytime Congress had enacted one of these administrative schemes. And just to give you a sense of the practical importance of this issue, I think the Cochran case illustrates that as much as any of the thousands of cases out there involving individuals who find themselves trapped in these administrative proceedings. So Michelle Cochran was a mother of two, single mother of two, who worked for a small accounting firm in Texas. After a few years, she decided to leave the firm because of the abusive treatment from her boss, who she also had concerns about his honesty as well. She thought she'd moved on, but several years after she left, the SEC initiated an enforcement action against her old firm, her boss, and lo and behold, Ms. Cochran herself. And Ms. Cochran's wrongdoing alleged by the SEC was that she had failed to essentially check various boxes in as part of an auditing form. It was the quintessential paperwork violation in which no one had been harmed from it, and there was no monetary loss as a result of this, but she left a couple of boxes blank, and the SEC went after her. The SEC settled the charges against the firm and with her boss, but she refused to settle. She was defending her innocence of this charge, and she proceeded before an SEC ALJ. That proceeding took several years. At the end of it, the SEC won, as it almost always does in its own courts, and imposed a $22,500 fine against Ms. Cochran and banned her from practicing in accounting for 5 years. She then brought that proceeding to the SEC Commission itself. While her case was before the SEC Commission, the Supreme Court decided SEC versus Lucia, in which it ironically held that the very ALJ that had considered her case was unconstitutional. You might think that was the end of the proceeding, but it wasn't. The commission sent it back before a new ALJ, and then she got smart and hired the New Civil Liberties Alliance to get involved and go to federal district court and bring a claim out of the box that the SEC ALJ was unconstitutional because it was protected by dual layers of removal from the president. SEC ALJs are only removable by cause by the Merit Systems Protection Board, and the members of the Merit Systems Protection Board, in turn, are only removable for good cause by the president, creating the sort of dual insulation from removal that the court in the Free Enterprise case said violated Article 2. The district court, however, believed that it did not have jurisdiction over Ms. Cochran's structural constitutional claim, that that jurisdiction had been displaced by the SEC scheme under the Thunder Basin analysis. She appealed to the Fifth Circuit, and the Fifth Circuit panel decision affirmed that conclusion. Now, the Fifth Circuit panel decision in Ms. Cochran's case was emblematic of decisions that the courts of appeals had reached going back almost a decade. The D.C. Circuit, Seventh Circuit, Fourth Circuit, Ninth Circuit, and 11th Circuit had all held, applying the Thunder Basin analysis, that district courts had been stripped of their jurisdiction to hear structural constitutional claims in the first instance, that individuals had to sort of endure the administrative process that they could. Most of them actually ultimately settle because they have to go on with their lives. But that after that process, they then could go to a federal court of appeals. I should note that there were three judges during this period who got it right and dissented. Judge Droney on the Second Circuit, Judge Hayes in the Fifth Circuit, and Judge Bumatai in the Ninth Circuit. During this period, the Supreme Court itself also denied certiorari twice on this issue, most recently in 2021 in a case that we worked on together with the New Civil Liberties Alliance. But the Fifth Circuit, in its wisdom, granted rehearing en banc in the Cochran case, and last year ultimately held in a 9-7 decision that there was jurisdiction, the district courts had jurisdiction to hear Ms. Cochran's structural constitutional challenge to her ALJ. That created a conflict in the circuit. A case out of the Ninth Circuit, the Axon case, which actually dealt with this issue in the context of FTC proceedings, was pending before the court. The court granted review in that case. And then the government brought the Cochran case up there and urged it to hold it for the Axon case. We urged the court instead to grant review in Cochran as well to resolve once and for all that district courts had jurisdiction over challenges to structural constitutionality of the SEC administrative process, and the court agreed, and so heard both cases together. The cases were argued back to back in November. The court issued its decision about a week and a half ago, unanimously finding that the district courts do have jurisdiction to hear these structural constitutional claims. So Justice Kagan wrote the opinion for the court, and eight members. Justice Gorsuch, as I'll mention in a second, wrote separately. He concurred in the judgment. Justice Kagan's opinion applied the Thunder Basin factors, though in a more forgiving way than the federal courts of appeals had done for the decade prior. She first looked to whether or not delaying judicial review would foreclose meaningful review of the question, and concluded that it would. And in doing so, she recognized that being subjective to an administrative process that was structurally in violation of the Constitution itself inflicts what the court in Celia Law had recognized was a here and now injury that could not be redressed if the individual had been dragged through that process in the first place. And so therefore, in order to get meaningful review, you needed to get review now. And so she got past the first Thunder Basin factor. The next factor looks to whether or not the claims were collateral to the agency proceedings, and she concluded that Ms. Cochran's claim was. It was a claim to the structural constitutionality of the ALJ itself. It had nothing to do at all with anything that had happened in the underlying proceeding. And the third factor was whether or not the agency had expertise to resolve this type of claim, and once again, she easily concluded that it did not. And as the court has recognized in prior cases, agencies generally have no special expertise to resolve structural constitutional issues. So she concluded in a compelling fashion that each of the Thunder Basin factors had been satisfied and pointed to the conclusion that neither the SEC Act nor the FTC Act in the Axon case actually could be interpreted to preclude federal district court's jurisdiction under Section 1331 to hear these structural claims at the outset. So Justice Thomas concurred in the result, but wrote separately to, as he often does, to up the ante considerably. He wrote in a concurring opinion that he had grave doubts about what he called the constitutional propriety of Congress vesting administrative agencies with primary authority to adjudicate core private rights, rights affecting life, liberty, or property, with only deferential judicial review at the back end. In other words, forcing the individual to go through a process where her life, liberty, property was at stake, and only getting judicial review in a petition for review of that proceeding in the Court of Appeals, in which there are a number of deference doctrines that would apply to the agency's findings of fact and certain other determinations. He questioned whether that was consistent with the Constitution at all, and said that if private rights were at stake, the Constitution likely requires plenary Article III jurisdiction over such claims. It wasn't necessary for Justice Thomas to go further in this case, but as we'll talk about later, this may be an important decision down the road in cases like Jarkissi. So Justice Gorsuch concurred only in the judgment. He wrote separately to say and argue strenuously that he would dispense with the Thunder Basin analysis altogether, as he would have analyzed it simply as a matter of statutory interpretation, look to the text of Section 31, which broadly says that district courts shall have jurisdiction over all constitutional claims or claims under law or treaties, and then look to the relevant agency statutes and find that nothing in those statutes remotely purports to strip district courts of that jurisdiction. He questioned the authority of the courts to engage in implied jurisdiction stripping at all, which is the import of the Thunder Basin analysis, and explained quite strongly, I think, that the Thunder Basin analysis carries real costs, both for individuals seeking to vindicate their rights and for lower courts who, he said, deserved better guidance. So thinking about the implications and significance of this decision, first, very importantly, provides a direct avenue of Article III judicial review for individuals or entities raising structural constitutional challenges to administrative proceedings. This could come in a number of different forms. In both the Axon case and the Cochran case, they raised an Article II challenge to the fact that ALJs are insulated from presidential removal unconstitutionally in the plaintiff's view. But you could imagine claims in the form of more conventional appointments clause violations, perhaps challenges to agency funding, like in the CFPB case, possibly Seventh Amendment challenges to jury trial rights, non-delegation challenges, other challenges that people may come up with. So this is a very important class of fundamental constitutional challenges that can now be brought directly into district court challenging agency action. Second, I think it is important that the court unanimously underscored that these sorts of structural constitutional defects do inflict a here and now injury, which I think magnifies the importance of this class of claims. Although the court and the majority opinion said that its decision shouldn't be read as professing a desire for more interlocutory review of this type, I think the fact that the decision was unanimous and the fact that it's written in fairly broad terms does signal a different approach to the Thunder Basin analysis. At a bare minimum, it shows that the courts of appeals that over the course of a decade had read Thunder Basin to require divesting district courts of this class of claims had been fundamentally wrong. And so I think it does require sort of a new understanding of the Thunder Basin analysis and a more forgiving analysis for finding jurisdiction. And I think that Justice Thomas's concurring opinion and Justice Gorsuch's opinion concurring in the judgment, both may have, you know, lasting importance on their own. Justice Thomas's opinion, to the extent that it invigorates underlying constitutional claims in this context, and Justice Gorsuch's opinion, to the extent that it ultimately leads to the abrogation of the Thunder Basin Doctrine altogether. So let me just touch on Jarkissi briefly. So the SEC versus Jarkissi is actually one of the cases that had initially raised this jurisdictional claim and went up to the DC Circuit, and the DC Circuit in 2015 held that Mr. Jarkissi couldn't, there wasn't district court jurisdiction for him to bring structural constitutional challenges to the SEC proceeding against him. So he went back, endured the SEC proceedings. They entered an order against him. He then petitioned for review to the Fifth Circuit and raised a host of important constitutional challenges to the SEC's authority, which a majority of the Fifth Circuit adopted in significant respect. So the Fifth Circuit in this case held that the SEC's ALJ's double-layered protection from removal, the very claim in the Cochran case, had merit, and that the SEC ALJs were unconstitutional for that reason alone. And then it went further to find that there was a Seventh Amendment violation in subjecting individuals to civil penalties in SEC administrative proceedings without a jury trial, and also that there was a non-delegation defect insofar as Congress had purportedly given the SEC the authority to proceed either in-house before its judges or in a federal court, that broad delegation of power violated non-delegation principles. This is a very significant constitutional ruling in itself. The government recently petitioned for certiorari of the Jarkissi decision. That petition is now pending before the court, but given that the Fifth Circuit's ruling declares unconstitutional fundamental aspects of the SEC administrative scheme, I think there's a very strong chance that the court ultimately would grant review in the Jarkissi case and hear it next term.
Thank you so much, Greg. And we'll definitely discuss more about Jarkissi coming up. I'd like to turn to you, Professor Pierce, for your opening statement.
So let me start by congratulating Greg on his victory in the Cochran case. And as somebody who is on the other side on the merits issue that he's raised, I have to say I agree completely with the court on the jurisdictional issue on which he's already prevailed unanimously. I think that opinion is well-reasoned, and I think it reaches the right result. I don't think anybody's interests are served by prolonged delay in knowing whether the basic structure of the administrative state is constitutional. I think the earlier we all get answers to those questions, the better for everyone. So I really applaud the court and Greg on that. I count eight constitutional and structural attacks that are likely to come before the court in the next 3 years. So this has really opened the way to a lot of things that will allow those of us who make a living writing law review articles provide us endless work. Now, the merits issue in the Cochran case is the constitutionality of the for-cause limit on the power of the head of the agency to remove an ALJ. And on that issue, I disagree completely with Greg. So let me go through the history of this. During the 1930s, there were lots and lots of complaints to Congress about the systemic bias of what were then called hearing examiners, now referred to as administrative law judges. The allegation was that they were systemically biased in favor of the agencies where they presided. There were a couple of studies that supported those complaints. So Congress was trying to figure out, well, what to do. Well, after over a decade of deliberation and consideration of a wide variety of potential solutions, they came up with one that I think was really quite clever and continues to do the job very well. First thing is to try to provide as much decisional independence to the ALJ as possible. And there are actually six different provisions of the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946 that are designed to accomplish that. The most important of those provisions is the provision that says that the head of the agency cannot remove or otherwise discipline an ALJ without having a cause to do so. And that's critically important if you're going to try to minimize the role of systemic pro-agency bias. In the absence of that kind of a safeguard, it's pretty easy for the head of the agency just to say, I'm the boss, sport, decide it my way, pretty big clout implicitly behind that command. And we have studies in the context of a couple of other agencies where they don't use ALJs, they use instead adjudicators that are not subject to those safeguards, that those adjudicators report that they are subject to systemic bias, pressure all the time from the political leadership of an agency to decide a case a particular way. So Congress said, okay, we're going to confer on ALJs these six different sources of insulation from potential pressure from the head of the agency in order to minimize the risk of systemic pro-agency bias, including, most importantly, the limit on the power of the agency head to remove an ALJ. Now, Congress at the same time recognized that while most adjudications do not raise significant policy issues that should ever come to the attention of the president or any senior political official, sometimes they do. And so in that same statute, the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946, Congress provided that the agency could, if it chose, replace the ALJ's decision with its own decision. And all of the regulatory agencies have procedures through which that can be accomplished through an application of an intra-agency appeals process. So in the rare case where an adjudicatory decision issued by an ALJ raises some serious policy issue, the head of the agency can replace the ALJ's decision with his own decision. Well, that provides a much more transparent means through which the president can exercise control over policymaking within an agency. And I think the worst possible step we could take at this point is to eliminate that major source of insulation from systemic bias, thereby leaving all ALJs subject to the whims and caprices of their political bosses to say, I want you to decide this case this way, and thereby controlling the outcome of a lot of adjudications in a completely non-transparent way. So I'm against him completely on the merits issue that will come next before the court in that case, but I continue to applaud his wonderful victory on the jurisdictional and timing issue. I think that was very important. I just want to mention briefly two other cases that we may come back to later in the discussion. One is the challenge to the funding of the CFPB as a violation of the Appropriations Clause. As part of the architecture of the statute that created the CFPB, what Congress was trying to do there was to create an agency that was as independent of the executive branch as possible. And one of the means they chose to do that was to provide a mechanism through which it could be funded without going through the appropriations process, so it could thereby avoid both OMB review and review through the appropriations process. And that has been challenged in another of the attacks on the structure of at least one agency. And I think that's a very serious challenge, and I'm not quite sure how it should come out, I am a bit concerned, though, that the court is likely to run into some serious line-drawing problems. There are many agencies that get a high proportion of their funding, in some cases 100% of their funding, through means other than appropriations, and therefore never have to go to OMB or to Congress to go through the appropriations process. In 1989, for instance, the Supreme Court upheld a statute that instructed the Department of Transportation to impose a tax on all pipelines in order to fund the newly enacted pipeline safety program to be implemented by the Department of Transportation. Congress made that decision and instructed the agency not to give the agency independence, but because Congress's view, that was an agency that should be completely self-funded, that the general public should not have to bear the cost of that agency. It was, after all, serving the interests of pipeline safety, and so the Supreme Court unanimously upheld that. Well, how is the court going to distinguish between arguably impermissible ways of circumventing the appropriations process and the OMB process that are intentionally designed to serve that purpose versus the many circumstances that for completely different and permissible reasons Congress has said that an agency should be wholly or partly funded through things like fees that it charges to get permits? That was the way that DOT exercised the authority that Congress conferred upon it in that case. So I think the court, if it decides that the CFPB funding mechanism is a violation of the appropriations clause, is going to have a lot of problems with line drawing in future cases.
Thank you so much, Professor Pierce. A lot of interesting topics to discuss there during the discussion portion. I will turn it over to you, Professor Scuteri, for your opening statement.
Great, thanks so much. So I think the AV is working, but someone let me know if that's not the case. So I want to spend the majority of my remarks talking about the CFPB case, in part because I have an essay coming out on it soon. But I want to start off by talking about a major theme that I think connects some of the cases we're talking about today. And that major theme is this concept that I like to call bubble wrapping, which is insulating agency action from literally all sorts of public input, whether that public input is channeled through Congress, the president, or the judiciary. And the idea is that public input is dangerous, and we have technocratic expert agencies who need to make decisions outside of the public oversight. So we need to protect that decision-making process by all means. And I, of course, disagree with that, but I think we see this show up in a few different areas. So let's start with the president, how agency action is bubble wrapped or insulated from the president's input. So as those of us that follow administrative law know, there's lots of provisions, we've talked about some of them today, that purport to limit the president's authority to remove executive branch officials from the executive branch. And the Roberts Court has made clear for some time that these removal protection provisions can present constitutional problems in various circumstances. So free enterprise, we learn, the accounting oversight board members, those are unconstitutional for being doubly insulated from the president's removal. CELA law, we learn that if you want to have an agency with a single head, that single head's going to need to be removable by the president. So it's unclear how much further down this path the Roberts Court might go to ensure that the president remains controller of the executive branch. But as mentioned in the Jarchese case, one of the questions presented is indeed this double insulation question about ALJs. Next, I want to think through how agency action is insulated from congressional oversight, public input being channeled through Congress. And here I think the CFPB case is a great example. So most agencies have to go to Congress with hat in hand and say, please give us appropriated funds so we can continue on the agency mission. And at that moment in time, Congress can pause, look at the agency policy, and determine, we are the people's elected representatives. Do we like this policy? Do we wish to continue funding it? And as we hear from Professor Pierce, the CFPB was designed specifically to be taken out of that appropriations process. So rather than have the people channeling their will through the elected representatives who will determine, hey, how are we going to spend the people's money? Do we like this policy? We have a situation where the CFPB just sends a note to the Fed and doesn't have to be subject to that congressional oversight. And then finally, I want to talk about the judiciary. So here we see efforts to insulate agency conduct from public input channeled through the public federal court system. And I think we see this in at least two scenarios. One are exhaustion requirements. So here, of course, we have agencies saying, no, you cannot subject us to review in a federal court until you go through this lengthy internal review process. After the work of Greg and NCLA and others, now that we have Axon and Cochran, of course, a lot of these structural constitutional arguments can get their day in court a lot earlier than they would have about 10 days ago even. Another example of, I think, insulating agency conduct, bubble wrapping the conduct from judicial intervention is the kind of aggressive action we've seen in the student loan cases. There we see the agency really making substantive changes to its policy mid-litigation on the fly for what looks to be the sole reason of insulating that agency action from judicial oversight. So that appears to be a pretty strong break with norms. Traditionally, you would present only those policies that you believe to be lawful and then defend the legality of those policies in court. So structuring a policy specifically to make it nearly impossible to challenge in court seems like another effort to kind of insulate, to bubble wrap the agency action from public input, this time coming through the federal court system. So that's how I see the cases kind of connecting at a 30,000 foot level. But let me dive a bit more deeply into the CFPB case. So Congress's appropriations power is surprisingly not it's not that well discussed generally in the administrative law scholarship or really even with a lot of judicial precedent. And I think that's surprising because on the grounds, whether an agency is going to receive funding is very important. But I think this relatively clean slate that we have about the appropriations power gives an originalist court like the Roberts Court a lot of room to maneuver and to think through the Congress's appropriations power from first principles. And when I say first principles, I really mean first principles. So what I think the court should consider in the CFPB case is start with the basic question, where in the Constitution is Congress vested with any authority to appropriate funds? And you might think, well, there's this thing called the Appropriations Clause, and sure enough, there is. But as I think is relatively uncontroversial, the Appropriations Clause doesn't actually vest Congress with the authority to appropriate funds. It refers to an appropriations power that is presumably vested elsewhere. The clause says no money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequences of appropriations made by law. And what this clause is doing is telling the President, you can't unilaterally take funds from the Treasury. You need to go to Congress. Okay, so where might Congress's appropriations power be vested? Well, the only other constitutional reference to the appropriations is, again, a limitation on some sort of appropriations power, not a grant of that power to begin with. And that, of course, is Article 1, Section 8, Clause 12, which essentially says, Congress, you can only appropriate funds for military ventures for 2 years at a time. Okay, so if those two references to appropriations don't vest the appropriations power, where does it come from? A lot of people would say the taxing clause, and that's probably where the court is about now. But I think the best reading of the taxing clause is to recognize it as just that, a power to tax, to bring in money, not treat it as a power to spend, right? So you have a power to bring in money for various enumerated reasons, promote common defense, general welfare, not to just spend blindly to promote those policies if they're unconnected to a specifically enumerated power. Okay, so where is the appropriation powers vested, right? Certainly we know that Congress can appropriate funds. Where does it come from? Well, according to my theory, it comes from the interconnection between two groups of constitutional provisions. So the first is Congress's substantive powers. So these are Congress's powers to punish piracies, to regulate interstate commerce, to establish tribunals, on and on. So we have those powers, and then it's the interconnection with Congress's necessary and proper clause authorities, which give Congress the power to make all laws necessary and proper to carry into execution some other power that's vested elsewhere. So the idea, for example, is a necessary and proper means for Congress to carry, say, its power to punish piracies into execution is for Congress to appropriate funds to maybe go, you know, catch pirates on the high seas or what have you. Another example, a statute that appropriates funds to buy military equipment, that is likely a necessary proper means of carrying the president's commander-in-chief power into execution. So Congress has the authority to make necessary and proper laws to carry some other power into execution, not just spend as Congress would like. Okay, so what power might Congress have been carrying into execution to fund the CFPB? I think arguably it's the Interstate Commerce Clause authority. So I think the question that the court should be asking in the CFPB appropriations case is whether this CFPB funding statute, which takes the CFPB out of the normal appropriations process, is that a necessary and proper means of Congress carrying into execution the Commerce Clause authority? And in the research that I've done to date, I suggest that no, that is not a necessary and proper exercise of the Commerce Clause authority. And why is that? Well, we start with a historical baseline of annual appropriations. This was the way that the governments familiar to the ordinary reader in 1788 when the Constitution was ratified, annual appropriations was how governments were funded. My understanding of England, early colonial American governments, and the first Congress adopted annual appropriations. The SG in the CFPB case, so far in its cert stage briefing, says, well, we have historical exceptions to this. Look at the way the post office is funded. It's funded through postal fees. Look at the way the National Mint was funded historically. It's funded through coinage fees. But if you adopt my framework, you realize that those examples are unhelpful to the government because those are examples of the government, of Congress, carrying its power to establish post offices into execution and its power to coin money, Article 1, Section 8, into execution. And it turns out there's historical support that would have been familiar to the ordinary reader in 1788 that, okay, yeah, the normal way of funding postal systems is through postal fees, and the normal way to fund the coining of money is through coinage fees. And I don't see a similar historical analog for Congress carrying its Interstate Commerce Clause authority into execution. So that's my pitch of what I think the court should do with the CFPB case. But I enjoyed the comments, and I look forward to see what questions Judge has for us.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for that overview. I think I want to start with you, Greg, and give you a chance to address what Professor Pierce was talking about. The Supreme Court's decision in your case that you argued now permits the plaintiffs to challenge the agency's proceedings in federal district court. And I was hoping you could discuss the merits claims. I think you might want to. In light of Professor Pierce's comments, and also how they might differ or how they're the same from the claims in Jarchese.
Right, so on the last point, the insulation from removal question in Cochran is really the same as the insulation from removal question in Jarchese because they're before the same injury agency and the same removal protections apply. And again, it's the SEC ALJs are only removable for good cause by the Merit Systems Protection Board, which in turn is their members are only removable by good cause by the president. And that sort of creates exactly the same problem that the Supreme Court identified in the Free Enterprise Fund case, which dealt with members of the so-called Peekaboo Board. And so the government's argument that Professor Pierce made well here today is that, well, ALJs are different because they're engaged in adjudicatory functions, and so the free enterprise analysis doesn't really apply here. And I guess I'm skeptical of that argument. For one thing, that the court in the Lucia case has already held that SEC ALJs are inferior officers for purposes of Article 2. For another, you know, the argument goes that the SEC ALJs, you know, wield broad authority, essentially, you know, exclusive authority over these important proceedings, can impose punishment in those proceedings and enter orders that have, you know, very serious implications for the respondents in those proceedings, and so therefore are sort of executive in that sense, or at the very most are sort of a quasi-judicial type officer that the Supreme Court in the Myers case had recognized were subject to the same sorts of removal protections. I think, though, that the professor raises a fair point to question whether or not, at the end of the day, if, you know, that we're better off at the scheme in which the ALJs are directly accountable, whether they're going to, you know, whether or not those protections for removal actually result in, you know, more independent decision making. I think that's debatable because the studies show right now that the SEC ALJs in these proceedings are, you know, ruling for the SEC in 90% of the cases. So I think if you look at the sort of objective evidence, it does not suggest that we have independent decision making going on at its finest right now. I also think you can debate whether or not you've got better SEC ALJs if they're, you know, truly accountable to the president versus just worrying about how the, you know, SEC or MSPB are going to, you know, view their actions. And at the end of the day, you know, maybe the right answer is that these proceedings really belong in federal court and not the agencies to begin with. I mean, the agencies have sort of, you know, taken the easy way out and funneling cases before these, you know, in-house proceedings in which they win in virtually all the cases. There's a separate route that Congress has provided, and that's to take these cases to a federal court, which is the place that we know that they can get an independent decision maker.
Professor Pierce, do you have anything you'd like to add?
Well, Greg just raised really what I consider a completely separate issue of whether these cases should instead be resolved in federal court, and that gets back to Jarchese, which is, that's one of the issues in Jarchese, although the Fifth Circuit decided to use the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial rather than Article III judicial power as the basis for its decision. I have taken a pretty close look at Jarchese, that aspect of Jarchese, and what would happen if the Fifth Circuit's approach were to prevail in that case. What the Fifth Circuit says is the reason that the Seventh Amendment right to jury trial applies is because there were fraud cases in 1789 that were triable before a jury, and that is one of the tests for determining whether Congress can allocate a class of adjudications to an agency. The problem is that the Fifth Circuit said, well, they weren't the same kind of fraud cases, but they were akin to this kind of fraud case. The Supreme Court has explicitly rejected that reasoning on two different occasions, saying the fact that a provision is a proceeding is analogous to a proceeding that could have been tried before a jury in 1789 is irrelevant. What we're interested in is whether this cause of action could have been tried before a jury in 1789. And that obviously is not the case with respect to this class of securities fraud cases. There were no such was no such cause of action in 1789. And if the Supreme Court were to adopt the Fifth Circuit's reasoning and change quite dramatically its approach to determining when Congress has the discretion to allocate a class of adjudications to agencies and say, well, whenever it's akin to, in the words of the Fifth Circuit, an action that could have been
tried before a jury in 1789. Well, we'd have a host of problems because I did a little Google search of the U.S. Code and discovered that there's over 1,000 places where the standard is just and reasonable. Just and reasonable was a standard that has been around in federal statutory law in many contexts for a very long time, and it's implemented almost exclusively by agencies, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, the Federal Communications Commission, and on and on. And that same term was used as the basis for jury trials in cases in which people challenge the validity of charges made by innkeepers. In England, as far back as the 14th century, it continued in England all the way through the time of England's arrival in North America. It crossed the pond with the Brits and was adopted as the common law of every colony in the United States, and you could get a jury trial on that issue. My God, if you can get a jury trial on the basis of anything that is akin to an action that you could get a jury trial on in 1789, well, the Supreme Court would have just multiplied the number of jury trials in the United States by a factor of somewhere between 100 and 10,000. And of course, we do not have the capacity to handle that volume in the Supreme Court. The problem with constitutional rulings is, you know, they can't just say, well, there's this one little slice of cases where the holding is almost certainly going to be applicable to a very broad, large number of cases. And they got to be really careful about how they decide these cases in a way that doesn't explode the entire legal system of the United States. The adoption of that Fifth Circuit decision in Jarchese would just explode the number of jury trials that would have to be made. And anybody who knows anything about the institution of jury trials, we use it only in less than 1% of civil cases. I mean, it is a real rarity when the right exists today. For very good reason, we don't have the resources to staff jury trials in large numbers. And so adoption of that theory would create tremendous practical problems that I don't think the Supreme Court wants to get into. So I suspect the Supreme Court will stick with its precedents and continue to say, no, that cause of action was not triable before a jury in 1789, and hence Congress does have the discretion to assign adjudication of that class of cases to an agency instead. But in any event, that is completely independent of the question of the constitutional validity of the four-cause limit on the power of the head of an agency to remove an administrative law judge.
Professor Squitieri, I was wondering, you've heard about the history of ALJs. What role do you think that they should play in our regulatory regime? And let's say the Fifth Circuit's ruling is adopted by the Supreme Court. Let's say first they take the case and then it's adopted. How should our ALJ system be restructured, perhaps, to avoid constitutional problems? What would you suggest?
Yeah, so I guess as an initial matter, I'm okay with ALJs adjudicating at least some claims, so long as the parties consent to that. Parties consent to arbitration, to litigating in front of magistrates, things like this all the time. So as long as the party's consenting, that's one way to carve a lot of cases off. If the Supreme Court were to adopt this ruling, I suppose I would want to see ALJs certainly accountable to removal by the president. I understand Professor Pierce's point that perhaps we want some sort of to mimic Article 3 somewhat and make them relatively independent. But as Greg mentions, I don't think the stats really show that out. I think ALJs are very often ruling with their home institutions. Even if we were to centralize, I've seen proposals to centralize ALJs, so they're not really connected to one of the agencies. I'm not sure that would do much good. So I think if they're within any branch at all, they're within the executive branch, and the president's head of the executive branch, so they should be removable by that the chief executive.
Well, speaking of removal, several recent cases have touched upon Humphrey's executor, and Jarchese involves presidential removal power as well. Professor Pierce, do you believe that Humphrey's executor is precedent that, precedent that is likely to stay intact with all these cases? You said there's at least eight cases, maybe not on this, but coming down the pike. And especially in the face of challenges like the one presented in Illumina, pending before the Fifth Circuit.
Yes. So, this is going to be a really fascinating case to watch, the Illuminati case. So here's what happened in outline form. Illuminati wanted to merge with Grail. Frankly, I don't understand the market. I don't know the firms. I'm only interested in the legal issues. That proposed merger did not raise any horizontal problems. It raised in the minds of the leadership, the current leadership of the Federal Trade Commission, a vertical problem. Well, that in itself is a bit unusual, since the FTC had not brought a case, had not challenged a merger based on alleged vertical problems in 50 years. But in any event, they decided that this merger would create some kinds of problems through vertical means. So they sent the case to an ALJ. They only have one ALJ, by the way. There's only one ALJ at the FTC. But they sent the case to their ALJ, and their ALJ had a full trial, and the ALJ said, I don't see a problem. And so he decided against the agency. Now, let me just stop there and ask you, how do you suppose he would have decided that case if he could be removed at will by Chair Khan? I don't have any doubt how that would have come down. But in any event,
I think that was the first time in the history of the FTC that an ALJ had actually not.
Recent history, agreed. Of course, there's always the possibility that the FTC was right in those other cases and wrong in this case. But in any event, that's the facts of this case. The FTC overruled the ALJ, and they went to court, and they're trying to enjoin the merger was already completed. So they're trying to force Illuminati to divest all of the assets of Grail. And Illuminati says, aha, what agency is trying to do this? The FTC. Well, the FTC is unconstitutional because the Supreme Court should overrule Humphrey's versus Humphrey's executor. So we have teed up here another big challenge, and if they overrule Humphrey's executor, then there's no question that would apply to virtually all agencies. There'd be a couple that wouldn't would still be out there, like the Mine Safety and Health Review Commission and the Occupational Safety and Health Review Commission that has nothing but adjudicative responsibilities. But all the other agencies that are now considered independent because their heads are subject to this four-cause limitation would be affected the same way if the Supreme Court overrules Humphrey's executor. I think there's an excellent chance that the Supreme Court will overrule Humphrey's executor. My friend and colleague Bill Kovacic can go through a whole long description of how the FTC has completely changed since the Supreme Court decided Humphrey's executor. And just the idea that it's quasi-adjudicated. He's only got one ALJ, and he doesn't have much to do. They don't do a whole lot of in-house adjudication anymore. The court. In Humphrey's executor said, well, they're quasi-legislative. Well, that's because back in 1935, Congress had no staff.
And so when Congress got complaints from constituents that there was a need that constituents received for legislation in some area, they turned to the FTC and asked for the FTC for advice. And the FTC sent these voluminous reports recommending what became the Natural Gas Act, the Federal Power Act, the Public Utility Holding Company Act. So they were an advisor of Congress. Well, of course it made some sense to have some degree of insulation between the president and the FTC, and that is not what the FTC does today. That bears no resemblance to what the FTC does today. But I think there's a very good chance that the Supreme Court will wind up overruling the Humphrey's executor holding, and I would applaud that. I think the whole idea of an independent agency these days makes just no sense at all. And what the agencies do today is not quasi-judicial and quasi-legislative. It is pure executive functions. And so it's about time that the Supreme Court, and I don't know how many of you were at lunch, but the question was asked of our two former FTC commissioners at lunch, well, would that make any difference? And they said, well, probably not. I think that's totally wrong if you think not just about today's circumstances at the FTC, but you think more broadly. Here's an example. We are 30 months into the Biden administration, and Joe Biden has no control over telecommunications policy, none, because that agency has been 2-2. The entire time that he's been, he may never get control. And I don't happen to like his policies in telecommunication, but I think a president should have control over it, not some people who were appointed long ago by his predecessor. And think about it another way. Suppose that a Republican is the next, elected as the next president. Do you suppose that if that Republican president had the power to remove the FTC chair at will, that Lina Khan would remain the chair of the Federal Trade Commission for more than 2 minutes after the inauguration ceremony? I mean, it's incredibly important to overrule that precedent. I think there's a good chance they'll overrule it, and Illuminati provides a wonderful set of facts to justify that action.
Well, I want to keep moving because we're starting to run short on time. So let me just turn to CFPB. Professor Scuteri, this is a particularly interesting case, I think, because the decision concludes that congressional action rather than executive action or judicial action can violate the Appropriations Clause. Do you think this matters in this particular case that we're talking about, Congress? And will the court perhaps be more deferential because we're talking about Congress delegating its own authority, perhaps, and be more inclined to respect the Article I branch's decision?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting distinction with the idea, like, normally we're reviewing perhaps executive branch practice with an agency, and should the court be more deferential to Congress than the executive branch? My inclination is no. I think the judiciary is a co-equal branch with the executive and with Congress. You shouldn't just overrule congressional decisions, just for kicks. But if Congress is exercising, operating outside of its legal authority, then it is the role of the judiciary to say as much. And I think often, particularly with Congress, the structural problems that we see of Congress are often Congress kind of giving authority to someone else. So in the non-delegation context, they tell the agencies to go be good and nice, and then Congress can take all the credit and none of the blame when the agency doesn't go be good and nice. I think similarly so here, Congress perhaps wants to duck having to fund controversial policies. And if this type of funding procedure gets approved by the Supreme Court going forward, I think you're gonna have a lot of agency heads lining up on Capitol Hill asking for this very same appropriations processing. I think Congress would be happy to duck a lot of those tough funding questions.
Do you think if plaintiffs win, will this ruling necessarily have implications for other agencies, or will perhaps be cabined to the facts of this particular agency and this particular ruling, yeah, because it is a slightly unique.
Yeah, well, if they adopt my approach, they can restrict it, at least to an exercise of the Commerce Clause authority in this instance. So wouldn't touch the post office, wouldn't touch the mint, wouldn't touch something like patent boards. So I think the court would be smart to be specific about the type of agency it's talking about, but because the CFPB is pretty unique and intentionally so, I'm not sure it would have wide ripple effects across the agency. However, if the CFPB wins, I think we will have wide ripple effects, because as I mentioned, I think other agencies are going to say we want that as well.
Let me turn to you, Greg. Let's say the Supreme Court does uphold the funding structure as Professor Squitieri led with. What do you think would be the consequence for Congress's role in our regulatory system? And sort of coupled on that, how important is the appropriations power in terms of accountability for federal agencies, in terms of oversight? Does it matter?
Well, I think it unquestionably matters. And I think, you know, the Supreme Court probably would view this as you know, critical to the separation of powers between the branches. And I think it's an interesting question to think about whether this case would look different if you just looked at it as the court reviewing a statute versus sort of the typical agency run amok. Although here, I think that the two are really combined in the sense is you've got this CFPB, which has this extraordinary power. And the question is whether this one aspect of its power, you know, really is constitutional. And I think, you know, it's likely to play out a little bit like Celia Law case and other cases where the court has looked at the CFPB and looked at, you know, really, is there any kind of historical analog for what we're seeing here, the way in which they set up the funding that you can go directly to the Fed for the funding. You know, Professor Pierce had mentioned the mining example earlier, and the government no doubt will come up with other examples. It might say that Congress has done similar things, but to the extent that the court views this really as a first-time type of thing, I think the court is not going to be particularly happy about it. And then the question will be, you know, how does the court craft its opinion? How does it draw the lines? But I think it would be concerned if it felt that, you know, even at the hands of Congress, it was setting up this agency that had this appropriations power that other agencies didn't. And I think that Professor Squitieri is right that if Congress can do this for the CFPB, you can bet that agencies will be lining up to get you know, similar power down the line.
Professor Squitieri, you touched upon this in your opening, but I'll ask you the same question. What does an agency's funding structure affect Congress's oversight power in a meaningful way?
Yeah, I think it does, because to keep the lights on, you need to make sure that Congress likes what you're doing, or at least you're not doing something that's bringing too much unwanted attention, congressional attention on yourself. You have the head of agencies routinely going forward to the committees, updating Congress about what they're doing. And if congressmen are unhappy, not only will they let you know with letters and op-eds and all that, but they could threaten to withhold your funding. So yeah, I think it's, if you are not subject to congressional funding, then I think that would make a big difference in the policies you proceed, which is why, if I might just add, I think the remedy in the CFPB case that the Fifth Circuit adopted is correct. The agency, we don't know, might have acted differently if it was subject to the constitutional limitations on funding. If it, you know, might think, is Congress going to be happy if I do this or not? So I think the remedy was correct, that you're unconstitutionally funded, so you can't spend any of those unconstitutional dollars on really anything.
We're running a little short on time, so I want to make sure I hit the student loan cases pretty quickly. Professor Pierce, these cases, before we get into sort of the major questions doctrine, they really implicate standing. There are some significant standing issues in the case. And can you just go over the standing issue a bit? And, you know, we're talking about the government perhaps giving money. It's hard to find harm sometimes when that's happening.
Yeah.
And because of this, do you think in these sort of cases, standing is perhaps going to be a more contentious issue going forward?
Okay, this is in the context of the student loan. Okay.
In the context of reviewing agency actions, where there's a similar sort of forgiving of debt or giving money out.
Well, that would almost always be, and maybe always, to be a presidential action if it happens at all. That's certainly what this was all about. The president saying, well, this is a national emergency. Now it's ended, hasn't it? But this is a national emergency, and therefore I'm modifying the terms of these contracts by canceling them. I think the government's argument on the merits is hopeless. I think it's extraordinarily weak. They will lose for sure if they get to the merits. What I think they were betting on was that the court wouldn't reach the merits because the standing issue is very problematic. It's very hard to see how any of the parties that are attempting to challenge this have standing under the normal precedence of the court. I think they clearly do not. However, on standing, I am in the cynics camp. I think when a majority of the Supreme Court wants to decide a case, they find standing. When they don't want to decide a case, they find no standing. It's very clear that a majority of the court wants to decide this case. So I think they'll find standing and it'll but I will say that more broadly, this is a problem, a broader problem. Suppose that the next president is a Democrat and says, I hereby authorize the spending of $1 trillion to fight climate change. Who has standing to challenge that? Under the precedents, no one. Suppose the next president is a Republican and he says, I hereby instruct IRS not to collect any taxes on capital gains, because I think they're immoral. Again, no one under their standing, I think they're gonna have to revisit standing law in order to allow them a point of entry into that class of cases, because those I think would be totally outrageous presidential actions.
Greg, do you agree with that point of view?
That those are outrageous presidential actions.
That standing might have to be revisited.
I definitely agree that the standing issue is the more challenging aspect of that case. And based on the oral argument, it appeared that there would be a majority in at least one of the cases that would find standing, but it was unclear. And so it came down, you know, that well could be a 5-4 ruling on standing, and then I think it'd be more lopsided on the merits if they get to that.
Professor Squitieri, I want to, especially since you are an expert on major questions doctrine, or at least have written extensively about it, the student loan cases implicate the major questions doctrine here. And, but it is in the context in these cases of an emergency authority. That is what the government is arguing. How should we think about the major questions doctrine in the context of authorities granted to Congress for agencies to respond to emergencies?
Yeah, so as far as the major questions doctrine is concerned, I'm not sure that the emergency status really matters. At least two of the major questions cases, the CDC moratorium case and the OSHA ETS case, both of those were emergency situations, and particularly the OSHA case, the standard was called an emergency temporary standard, and still OSHA lost under the major questions doctrine. So I definitely get the intuition that perhaps there might be moments when we might be more forgiving of a president in an emergency situation, but as far as doctrinally, with the major questions doctrine as it's been announced in the last 2 years or so, I don't think the emergency situation really cuts in the agency's favor or really cuts in any favor.
What do you think, if Congress was considering future legislation to take action in an emergency, what do you think that Congress should consider, in light of the major questions doctrine, and how granular does Congress need to get in detailing the action that the agency can take in responding to an emergency?
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting question because on one hand, you might think the answer is, well, Congress should just be very specific about what it wants the agency to do, the power it's granting the agency, clear congressional authorization as the court uses in the major questions cases. But the whole idea is that Congress really can't know what some future facts might present. So I'm not really sure Congress can adjust its the way it drafts legislation much to respond to the major questions auction. They certainly can to respond to non-delegation questions by just not being too vague. But as a major questions auction, I think part of what the court is signaling is that even in an emergency situation, like with COVID, we want to funnel decision-making authority back to the Article 1, Section 7 lawmaking process, back to Congress, and have Congress quickly give power to an agency. So I'm not really sure an agency could predict with enough specificity the necessary language because they don't know what's around the corner.
And let me throw one last question to you, Greg, about sort of if the Supreme Court upholds on the merits of the president's actions in this case, or the administration's actions, I should say, in this case, what would be the limit to the presidential authority here? How broadly do you think a president can interpret a statute to assume new authorities? I know we have West Virginia EPA.
Yeah.
Is that the limit, or is there no limit?
Yeah, I think it would take a major dent out of the major questions doctrine as it exists today. It'd be sort of hard to reconcile it. And yeah, I mean, I think it sort of goes back to the appropriations, the funding power, that if the president can do that, then I think there is a significant shift, at least in terms of how we've understood the funding power and the need for the executive to go to Congress to get that authorized through the appropriations process.
Let me see if we have any questions from the audience. I want to make sure people get their questions asked. Yes, sir.
Devin Watkins. My question is to Gregory. It concerns the Axion case. In deciding the court's jurisdiction to be able to hear these cases, perhaps do you think the court also decided the question for preliminary injunction as to whether there was irreparable harm? Because in deciding there is a here and now injury that can't be fixed by a court of appeals, it seems like for injunctions, the only thing left is if they would actually prevail or likely to prevail for a preliminary injunction. Is that your opinion of how you would read Axion?
I think that's a good point. I mean, I think that'd be a fair argument based on the decision. I mean, it wasn't really teed up in that way specifically as, you know, meeting the injunction factors, and you know, the government probably would argue that, but I think it lends support to that argument that the court's recognition of that here and now injury would be a type of irreparable harm.
Yes, sir.
Mark Chenoweth, New Civil Liberties Alliance. Greg, thank you for mentioning NCLA's role in Cochrane. We've actually been involved in all four of the categories that this panel covers. Three of them with original litigation and one as amicus. So if you want to litigate, we are hiring. If you're, you know, if this is the kind of thing that you want to do, drop us a resume. But my question for you, Greg, is what about stays on administrative proceedings? Are they going to be mandatory now, given that this has been deemed a here and now injury for proceedings to go forward in front of allegedly unconstitutional ALJs?
Yeah, thanks, Mark. And Mark was an integral member of the Cochrane team. That may be the next battleground. So all these cases go back, and we'll see, you know, new Article III actions in the district courts challenging the SEC and FTC proceedings. And then the question will be, can the agency proceedings go forward, or do you have to adjudicate the district court action first? And I certainly think the better argument is that you should adjudicate the structural constitutional claims first, you know, getting back to the here and now injury point that we just mentioned. But I think there will be litigation on that, and I suspect district courts might go different ways. And you know, maybe that issue will get up to the court at some point.
Thank you. Yes.
I'm Jerry Cox. I have a question for Professor Pierce. You predict that Jarchese would result in this enormous increase in jury trials. Are you not assuming that the agencies would bring in district court all the cases they currently put in front of their own ALJs? And the reason I ask that question is because I have handled dozens and dozens of agency administrative enforcement actions, and I will tell you, every single one of them was utter garbage. They would never, ever put that in front of a U.S. district judge to save their lives. They will only put it in front of ALJs who they know will rule 100% in their favor. So how do you get to the conclusion that you're going to have a huge increase from Dracasey because of
when I was in practice, I handled a few hundred of those cases.
On the garbage side or the non-garbage side?
I often differed with the agency. I never had occasion to characterize their position as garbage. Most of those cases are rate-making cases. That's the just and reasonable standard that was applied in jury trials as long ago as the 15th century and was applied and certainly in 1789. Was applied to innkeepers in jury trials. Today, all of that is done by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in determining rates and by the Federal Communications Commission in determining rates and the Surface Transportation Board in determining rates. And those cases, I don't know what you mean by garbage, because every one of those cases is the customers against the supplier.
I'd be happy to give anybody a list of garbage cases that I guarantee you will never go. Cases like those coming out of the Transportation Department, the Energy Department, and so forth, they would never go to a U.S. District Judge with a straight face. It just wouldn't happen.
Well, I don't know where else you're going to get rate making accomplished if agencies are not allowed to do it, because the regulated firm is entitled to a jury trial in every case. As customers, and you're all customers of regulated utilities, you would have nothing if they don't go to court and win a hell of a lot of jury verdicts. And I don't know where we would come up with the resources to handle all those jury trials.
I'm talking about enforcement cases. I'm going to sit down now, but I'm talking about enforcement cases where agencies are trying to take away property of regulated entities by making allegations.
The regulated entities make that argument in every rate case, every single rate case. That is one of their arguments, that the government is taking their property.
All I can say is I hope that we get a favorable decision in Dracasey and you find out that you're wrong about the number that we're
I think
you
we have
put
time.
Some money on that. I'm glad to talk with you afterwards. Otherwise, I'm through.
I think we have time for one more question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, I have David Tryon with the Buckeye Institute in Ohio. Just a similar question in jury trials. My experience with jury trials is you never get there. 99% of all civil cases and most criminal cases, but I don't know anything about those because I don't do that. But almost all are settled. They're either handled through a magistrate that mediates them and gets them settled, or otherwise they're settled. So do you really believe that you would actually get to a jury trial and all those things, or would they have a similar settlement rate?
That's a good point. The most cases that are theoretically subject to a jury trial, we know the figures on that. We've got solid figures on that. Slightly over 99% never go to the jury where the jury trial, but that then raises the question of what the hell is good as a right that nobody can exercise as a practical matter, and nobody does exercise except in less than 1% of all cases. I have a big problem with the Seventh Amendment generally.
Thank you.
Well, I hate to end on that note, but I think that have hit our time. And as you can see, there's so much to talk about with these cases. We could talk for hours about it, but unfortunately we cannot today. I want to thank our wonderful panel for this discussion and our great audience for some really great questions. Thank you so much to all of you.